My name is Dr. Stacy. I am the host of the Mindful World Parenting Summit, and I'm thrilled to be joined today by Natalie Christensen and Nathan McTay. They are the founders of the Center for Emotional Education, where for the past 13 years, they've been helping parents have the relationships they really want, relationships that involve connection, give and take, without overworking, selling themselves out, or becoming people they really don't respect. The core of their work is helping parents cultivate what they refer to as emotional sovereignty within themselves and their children through mastery of brain state awareness and wizard levels of emotional intelligence. They're here today to talk to us about how to speak brain with your child, especially during the pandemic. Welcome, Natalie and Nathan, to the summit.
Hi.
Hey, it's great to be here with you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much for joining us. Okay, let's just jump right in. Tell me, what do you mean by speak brain? What does that mean?
Yeah, good place to start. So there are lots of parts of the brain and lots of ways to refer to the brain and to divide the brain up into, you know, different sections that we can talk about. We refer to three main brain states that all brains have and use regularly. The first one that we talk about is the survival brain state. And this regulates our autonomic nervous system, like our heart rate, our temperature, our digestion, our immune system, all of that kind of stuff. It also keeps us alive when we're threatened by with our fight, flight, freeze, or appease reactions. And then when our safety needs are met, this network will open access to the next one above called the emotional brain, or that we refer to as the emotional brain.
And the emotional brain, it actually initiates an emotional response neurochemically. And then it helps us process and understand those feelings. And then it supports us to connect with others around those feelings. It also, when we are supporting somebody else, like somebody else is upset, that's the part of our brain that helps us understand what that other person is feeling. So that's our, like, ooh, I feel that with you part of our brain. And when its needs are met, because it has its own set of needs, when its needs are met, it says, great, I open the gates. Now you have access to your executive brain.
So then the executive brain is where we do all of our noticing and our learning and our thinking and our planning and our problem solving. It supports our self-awareness and our self-mastery, which is both for, for regulating if we're in an emotional state that's uncomfortable or dysregulated. And it also supports us with that self-mastery piece is for controlling our impulses, our motor mastery. And then also this network supports our compassion and our ability to cooperate with others.
So, like, I know all the parents are like, ooh, cooperation. I want that. But that's the brain state. We all really like that one a whole bunch. And the way it works is that there's this, what Nathan coined as functional priority, which is that when there's a threat in the environment, we like to use the example of a grizzly bear because we're currently in Missoula, Montana. here comes a grizzly bear, right? And that under those circumstances, threat, the executive brain and the emotional brain, they shut down. It is not helpful to be in those parts of the brain. The executive brain that would say, is that a grizzly or a brown bear? Oh, how long are those claws? Are those 3 inches? Or not great, right? Grizzly bear eats you. Likewise with the emotional brain, like, am I scared? No, I'm not scared. Like, I actually feel pretty brave about this bear. Not a great time to have, awareness of emotions and like connect with others around. Are you scared? Because I'm scared. None of that would help, right? Grizzly bear would eat you. When there's threat, it makes sense for the survival brain to kick in and it'll save your life, right? Here comes a grizzly bear. So you either fight the bear, like grab a stick, fight it, you survive. Run super, super fast. Get to that tree. Climb the tree. Great. Stay alive. Freeze. Hope that the bear doesn't see you and get really quiet, really, really quiet. And it just passes by. Awesome. Sort of a last ditch attempt would be like, okay, just eat my arm, right? Just take my arm. You'd still live, right? Because survival brain just cares about living through this moment, living through this day, just surviving.
This system works really well when there's an actual grizzly bear or something like that that's threatening our survival. But the problem occurs when this happens, and this does happen a lot in parenting, but this same survival response kicks in even when it's not a grizzly bear that's actually present. It happens when an emotion is strong and our system feels fear around that and thinks that maybe the environment isn't safe for the emotion, say, or like when rage may occur, like when a sibling takes a toy or something like that, to put it in a kid example, or when there's a buildup of emotion. So the survival brain reads even that scenario as a survival scenario. And even when just a number of small upsets accrue over the course of a day, especially for a child, the survival brain can kick on in that instance to protect us from that scenario, thinking that's almost like a grizzly bear.
Mm-hmm. So then the
big like explosions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, either a big emotion or like just a lot of little ones, a lot of upsets. We didn't get ice cream and we couldn't go to the park and I also didn't get the other thing, you know, just like it stacks up and then the system goes, there's too much, too many emotions here, must be an emergency. Hello, survival brain.
Right.
It really matters as a parent because we're like, hey, there's two of those toys. You can play with the other one, right? We're trying to negotiate toy sharing or explain something about why we can't go to the park right now. Or, well, there's this thing called coronavirus, so we can't leave our house. Like, we're trying to do this, like, logicking thing and, like, help the kid basically not be upset if they can understand what's happening or if they can see there's two toys or there's a way to solve this. And we're trying to do that negotiating with a kid that is not in the brain state that does negotiating. They're in a survival brain state. So we say there's two toys and they go, no, there isn't, right? You're like, they just fight you. No, there isn't. I hate that toy. And they throw it, you know, or they bolt from the room. Or they go and hide under the dining room table. And you're just like, what the heck? Or they're like so swamped by just a number of emotions that they can't see through the fog of their emotions to even hear what you're saying. And so you finish saying your thing, but then they go, yeah, but I really want it. And you're like, yeah, I know. I know you do. But remember, there's two and there's not enough or it's not time. You're like, remember all that logic I just used? Yeah, but I want it. Right? That fog.
We're talking like different.
Yes.
Exactly. And those parts, yeah. And those parts don't communicate well with each other. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to make an executive brain address. Let me help you see how this could be fixed or let me address this situation. And they're not even able to attend to that level of communication. Because they're still maybe in the, like, the only options I have, and this isn't a cognitive way of relating to it, this is just sort of like the way their system is relating to it, that the only options they have are to fight, to run, to freeze up, or to try to appease, like offering the arm, as Natalie was saying. And so when we try to make this address of, you know, oh, let's talk about the logical aspects or the, you know, practical aspects of this situation, their brains just can't attend to that right then. So what we mean by speaking brain is to identify the brain state that our child is in and talk to that part of the brain that's driving.
Because it can only be in one part of your brain at a time, unfortunately, right? Because we're like, hey, how about you don't be in that state that you're in and come join me over here? Well, they can't. You actually have to meet them where they are. As you might imagine with the grizzly bear state, like you get into that state and you're running from a grizzly bear and somebody goes, it's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. And you're like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm still running, you know?
Or if they were to sort of lean back on the example that we were giving earlier, you know, if someone was then like, hey, do you think that was a brown bear or a grizzly bear?
You're like,
I don't know.
I don't care.
Right. Love that. Love the example. So if some, let's stick with the grizzly bear because when the child is in that state, then what is the parental response to meet them where they're at, to help them? I'm assuming we're wanting to help them come into a higher state, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the basic approach, is we meet them where they are and then we support them to bump up, as we say. So the first step of that is to actually identify the brain state that your child's in. Okay. And there's a few sort of telltale signs. so for in the survival brain, they may be doing things like yelling or hitting or running away or trying to hide, or they may go, stoic and go completely silent. They may start giving ultimatums like it's only this way or that way, or refusing utterly to move at all.
They're like, you either give me more cookies or I'm not going to bed, right. A or B, both are bad. You're like, oh, I'm not going to bed. Give them cookies. Hate those options.
Yeah. Right. But from the survival brain, you really can tend to only see one or two options. So again, it's useful to support them to move up to a brain state where they might have access to more options.
Well, and also as parents, when the kid is, arms crossed and this or that, we go into a story of like, oh my gosh, I think I have a crappy kid or something. I think that they're maybe not respectful, and they just don't understand the rhythms of the family, and they the nerve they have demanding something like that.
And there's this pressure too to kind of nip that behavior in the bud. Don't let them get away with that. Don't let them, treat you that way or manipulate you that way.
But really, none of us are compassionate, logical, kind people from our survival brains. That's not the point of that brain state. Mm-hmm. It is to stay alive and only that, right? So it's not like, oh, I'm worried about this person. No, just trample that person, right? To stay alive. Mm-hmm. So it's not a personal thing about your kid.
Right.
It's just a neurochemical state.
So then identifying the emotional brain state.
Yeah, so the emotional brain state, it's familiar. It involves lots of complaining and crying and hold me and asking illogical questions. But why? Why can't we have a second dessert? And then you respond and then they go, yeah, but why? Right. They're looking for help. They go, this isn't working. And you go, oh, well, have you tried that? No, I don't want to try that. Right. You offer options and ideas and they don't like any of them. They tell the story of what happened from a negative perspective. Like, I was doing nothing and she's terrible and she's always doing that. And I was just playing and she never lets me play. And you're like, that's not true. It's an untrue, exaggerated story. And if you're lucky, sometimes they name feelings in that, I'm just mad, or I'm sad because she won't let me play. You sometimes can hear some of that. These are clues that the emotional brain, the survival brain is okay. So it says you have access to emotional brain. Now the emotional brain is very active and it's doing what it does. It's initiating feelings, sharing feelings in the hope of connecting, that kind of thing.
Well, as you can see from Natalie's embodiment of it, there's a lot of body language that goes with it too. There's that sort of droopy kind of element, or they may get kind of rigid or start moving fast or be rough with their emotions, not their emotions. So all of those are signs of being in an emotional brain state. Now, when our kids especially are in an executive brain state, it can be pretty obvious because that's when we see them really having, they're much more graceful, they have much more control over themselves, they have a much lighter attitude about things. They can easily come up with their own creative solutions to solve problems. They tend to be more cooperative. They can actually hold space, especially once they're a little bit older, for logic and rationale. They can make plans, consider the other person's the other person's experience. They may even make jokes or start making requests instead of complaining. They can empathize with others and even choose compassionate action. So like when they're in an executive brain state, that's when we're like, oh man, I have the best kid in the world. Like this is like, I wish everybody could see my kid. Like if everyone's kid was as good as my kid, we'd all have a happier planet.
Right. Okay. So, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about, I have two very different kids, and my older one, he will scream at me when I get too intellectual with him. And he's just like, you're taking too long to talk to me. Like, what are you? It's like, okay. It's because I'm, so he lets me know when I am being over intellectual with him. Mm. And then I have a daughter who's very sensitive that can ramp up really quickly. Mm. And she makes it very obvious that I cannot talk to her. And I'm just like I'm holding space. And I'm just like, okay, like, what do you need to be safe? And I go in, like, do you need a hug right now? What was, you know, I'm just trying to keep it short, simple, offering help and watching her to see how she's preferring to self-regulate right now. Tell me, like, give me some feedback about that approach.
Well, I think your inclination is actually pretty great.
Okay.
To allow space, to allow time, to remain in the support role, but not to try to push your agenda.
And you can tell when you are talking to the wrong part of the brain, like you said, your son lets you know, right? He's like, you're talking too much. It's just too much words you're using, you know. That's one really clear way to tell when we're talking to the wrong part of the brain is that we get a reaction because when we use a language that's not appropriate for that brain state, the system sees it as greater threat. So if I'm in a survival state and I'm like curled up in a blankie and I don't want to talk to anybody and I'm covering my eyes, and you come in and you go, oh, I'll just talk about it. Like, what is this? Are you feeling bummed out? Are you worried about something? Like, you want a glass of water? Do you think you need a drink? Have you had so much, how are you just going to do some resting? Right? Too many words for me. And so my system goes, oh gosh, it's even less safe than I thought. And so you see a reaction that is a doubling down on that brain state. So going further or leaving the room or lashing out like, I said, don't talk to me, that kind of thing. So you get some communication that, oh, I was speaking the wrong language for this brain state. So it's really easy to tell when you got it wrong.
Yeah.
And by wrong, we just mean talking to the part of the brain that's not driving currently. And so it's going to bounce off.
We make the misstep and then they give us the feedback. And what's the response? Like how, because I think that's the most difficult. Like most parents can do the higher. It's the lower that we have a hard time because we get activated, right? Like the parent gets activated and it's there in their probably like, you know, heightened state. Or, I mean, maybe they're totally zen and they're just talking like that. So tell me.
Yeah. So there are a few ways that are really important to talk to the part of the brain that's currently driving. And so we have a few different protocols for each brain state. Natalie, you want to do the survival one?
Yeah. So the survival one, like we gave you the clues, right? They're hiding, they're running, they're yelling, they're, you know, they got the space on, they don't want you to come near, touch, you know, that kind of thing. Survival. So what that brain state responds to is a general communication of physical safety. So it means slow movements, very few words, understanding murmurs instead of words like no matter what they're saying, right? Staying in proximity. So you being this safe entity that is near them is a regulating presence. That proximity is important. You have to read the clues because too much, and they go, get off me. I didn't want you to snuggle me, right? So you actually want to just be safe enough to communicate safety, but not so close that it communicates the opposite. So offering touch if it's welcome. So maybe just start with like this. And then if it gets shrugged off, it's just nearby, but not touching. Mm-hmm. If it's welcome, then maybe you would add another. Mm-hmm. And by welcome, it's not like they're going to go, oh, that feels nice on my shoulder. They're just not going to yell at you or move, you know. And another key, really key element is allowing time to pass. Because if a grizzly bear pops out, we start running, right, without even thinking about it. We have that survival reaction. That's a, how many?
It's like 2 milliseconds.
2 milliseconds, right. Yeah. But in order to climb out of that survival state, it takes longer. And this makes sense, right? You wouldn't want to emerge while the bear is still there. Mm-hmm. So your system makes sure to keep you safe by not allowing that survival reaction to let go very easily. So you have to allow for actually minutes. So we use very few words, literally move slowly, because any quick movement would initiate more survival response. And then I glance at the clock because it can feel like an eternity, like a really long time. So I look at the clock because 5 minutes, you know, can feel like a half an hour when you are trying to help somebody regulate. So I just keep an eye on the clock just to chill myself out, you know, and know that it's going to take at least 5 minutes. It's probably going to, very upset. It's probably going to be 10 minutes. You know, like time is a very crucial element.
And again, that's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did you have a question? I was going to say, like, it is really the embodiment though of being the calm, stable force that's there. Everything is okay. Your emotions are okay. We're going to be okay. Like, we're just that force that they can feel. Like, they feel that in us, right?
Yeah. You're really getting the sense of it just by the way that you're feeding that back to us. I can really tell. I think it's also one thing that's useful to point out there is that if we're moving too fast or we're just allowing ourselves to be in a dysregulated state, then we just kind of amp up the survival reactivity.
Totally.
And I just wanted to just put in this part too, that I think it's really useful to ask for permission, even with our really young kids, if we're going to invite touch. Like, is it okay if I put my hand on your knee, or is it okay if I rub your back? Even our toddlers are old enough to give consent or not for something like that. And I think that invites a greater sense of trust.
Yeah. Very good point. Thanks for mentioning that. Okay. And so things start to calm down. And so you're starting to rise out of that survival mode.
Yeah.
What happened next?
So once we have a sense that they're moving into their emotional brain, which again, they may soften, they may start to cry, they may start to tell some of the feelings that they have, if they have that language.
They want more touch.
Yeah, they want to be held, they may lean in, you know, they may come find you if you're not right there. When we have a sense that they're in their emotional brain, we want to continue to move in such a way that we're communicating safety and that we're holding the emotional space. We want to match their gaze if they're doing eye contact with us, but not so much that we're like, you know, kind of staring into them or we're not kind of forcing eye contact at all, because that is read as threatening by the system.
Good point, yeah.
So then we can also help them to name some of the emotions if they haven't already. So what are you feeling? What is that like for you? Where is it showing up for you? Is it anger? Is it sadness? Is it, you know, you can offer ideas. But we want to make sure to offer them in such a way that the child has the opportunity to say yes or no, or yeah, you know, that's it, or no, it's more like this, so that we're honoring their actual emotional experience.
Mm-hmm. So rather than saying, why were you so mad, let's say, how are you feeling?
Yeah.
Is it that? Right? Yeah. So not presuming.
Mm-hmm. Not presuming. A lot of parents do this. Yeah, well, you were just mad. I get it. You were just really so worried about that. And that does not communicate emotional safety, because emotional safety is, I'm having an experience. Is that something you're available for? So when somebody tells you what your experience is, that doesn't feel safe. So yeah, those inviting questions, like, even if you think they're mad, you can say, you seem mad. Is that what's happening?
Mm-hmm. And too, I find, especially with, you know, as our kids are developing language, so maybe earlier on in the process, you might say, you know, were you feeling upset or are you feeling upset? Using a kind of more general term like upset, and then they have the opportunity to lean in and maybe offer some other words that they have. And then we also want to add more touch, because that again is communicating more emotional safety. So, you know, if they're allowing it, you know, go on in for the hug or hold hands or rub the back. And then, you know, or like full on hug too, they may be ready for that. And the great thing about an actual hug or increasing the amount of touch is if we can provide safe touch for about 30 seconds or more, then we shift the neurochemistry in their brain. We invite oxytocin to be released, which is the connection hormone. So that really increases the sense of affiliation and connection that's happening between the two of you, and can invite them to move further into the executive brain state after that and to have more of a sense of cooperation.
Okay. Thank you for taking us through that most difficult arc of things. And then I assume then we could maybe then start to talk about what happened and problem solving and that kind of thing.
Exactly. So the clues that they're moving out of their emotional brain are that they readily make eye contact. Mm-hmm. They might start to joke around. Like, you know, you're snuggled and they go, your arm looks funny the way it is. You know, you're like, oh, okay. I think they're kind of processing and shifting into the executive brain, making jokes.
Or even something like, well, that was kind of weird, wasn't it? You know, if they're a little older, they may have some kind of relation to
they can, like, there's a little bit of self-reflection. Yeah. Or they'll suddenly talk about something off topic. You know, like, you're helping them upset about the toy, and then they'll go, well, all that goes on with the emotions, and then they'll go, so what is for dinner? And you're like, oh, new topic, okay.
Moving on.
Yeah. So that's when you know that they now have executive function on board. And so then you can circle back to the issue. Like, do you have any ideas about how to share that toy? Or what do you think you need next? Or do you want to make a plan for how to handle this? Or sometimes we just ask, so what do we do? Because again, this isn't a time to now tell them what's going to happen, because you're wanting to be on the same team. You may give them information. So this is information that you didn't have earlier. Like, this is why we're having what we're having for dinner, or this is why we're not doing more cookies right now, like some information. And then there's kind of like a, so what do we do? Right? Because you want them to, you want to ignite their problem solving thoughts. So those kinds of open-ended questions are really helpful, more than, so do you want to be in trouble for eating cookies or do you want to not eat cookies? You know, like, that's a false choice. You want to just say, oh, so what do we do? You really want cookies and I don't want to say yes to that
right now.
Then if they're in their executive brain, it's amazing actually what they'll come up with. They may say, I know, I'll have no cookies tonight and three tomorrow. And you're like, great. Love it.
Amazing. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's worth pointing out that, again, all of this, you know, we've mentioned it a couple of times, but I just want to underscore the idea that time needs to pass. And so part of the process that you're allowing for throughout all of this is for the time to pass, for the neurochemistry to shift, and for brain states to be compatible. Two, around the executive brain state, we often find, I think, I want to say with toddlers, it's something like 90% or more of the time. If you support them to move from a survival brain state into an emotional brain state, support their processing of the emotion, then by the time you get back to the original issue, it's like this big. And it's so easy for them to solve if they care about it at all.
Right.
Maybe that the issue was only there to give them an opportunity to release some of the feelings.
Okay. And so how, you know, this approach I can see it taking practice, but I love how you gave us the markers, the signs, what to look for. And I know everyone watching is going to be like, oh, now like they have this awareness, right? But how does this impact the development of children when they're, when this is practiced over and over again by their caregivers?
Yeah, this is the really, really exciting part. Because, you know, supporting our children where they are with, you know, if they're in an emotional brain state or survival brain state, that's really useful for the moment. Because then you can get back on the same team. You can actually do something about if there's an issue. You can help them release feelings that they may have been snowballing through the course of the day or weeks or whatever. But then doing this on a consistent basis means that we're actually offering them the opportunity to develop their brains in the most optimal way, because we're consistently supporting them to move into the executive brain state, which is the part that they're developing most often. And so frequent opportunities to be in the executive brain state means you're getting to develop that a lot more.
Okay. Go ahead.
It also means that, and boy, we want this for our kids. We want this for ourselves. We want this for like humankind, to come up against an emotion, right? Because we're going to have them all the time. Stuff is always happening that we don't like, and we have discomfort around it. So meeting them where they are, talking to the right part of the brain, means that we wire their brains to operate in such a way that when they come up against an emotion, they go, oh, I know what to do with this. I move through it. I'm with it. I ask myself questions about it. I sit with it. I let time pass. And then I bounce up into my executive version of myself where I can live according to my values. I know what I want to do. I see what my options are. I can cooperate with other people. But in contrast, most of us didn't get this emotional safety, this emotional support, right? So we're out in the world, we're from little, you know, onward. We come up against something uncomfortable. Somebody makes fun of us, or we skin our knee, or any tiny little thing, right? We have an emotion, and we have no experience of emotional support, no big safe person to walk with us through that emotion and make that eye contact and that touch and ask us how we're feeling. We didn't get that, right? So without that, we can't actually move through the emotional brain and onto the executive. Our only choice is to come up against emotion and bounce back from and respond to emotion from a survival brain state. So that's what you see everywhere, like just out in the world, somebody feels uncomfortable. What do? One of the four things: fight, flight, freeze, or appease. So they say, you did something wrong, right? They fight. I'm having a feeling you must've done something wrong. Or I'm having a feeling I'm going to run away. I'm going to quit that job. I'm going to burn down that relationship. I'm out, right? Or they freeze. They do nothing. Life happens to them. It's like a way of living without living, right? Just going through the motions, kind of just like keeping it small. Or a really common one is the appease response to upset emotion, like, oh, I'm feeling uncomfortable because I think you're mad at me or something like that. I'll say, yes, sure, yes. Oh, absolutely, no problem. When really my truth is no, yeah. I don't want that. But I'll say yes just to survive this moment, right? Mm-hmm. So what we're sparing our kids from is a life where you're just surviving. You're just getting through this moment. You're just getting through this day just to do it again the next day. Like, and then you, on that day, you use your four skills, fight, flight, freeze, repeat, and make it through that day. Instead, what we're setting them up for is come up against emotion, move through it, and then live according to who you are, what's right for you, what feels creatively, energetically true for you. That's where you live. You're not just surviving a day. You're actually living a real life.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. And if more of us could be doing this, can you imagine, right? Like, I feel you, I hear you. I'm so thankful that you're doing this work. Thank you. Because there isn't a proper school for this. And you've created this place to just focus on this and bring so many people into this awareness and this way of being to truly be able to thrive in life. And, you know, we're speaking now in the midst of like unprecedented scenario where we're all faced with this challenge. Life is on pause as we know it. I don't know if you feel the same way as me. I see this as such an opportunity to reset and rejig with all that we know. But, you know, there's lots of pressures on families at so many levels. And so, you know, during this pandemic, I see it as a time that you got, like, you're forced to figure out these emotions. And is there anything in particular about this approach or anything added, especially now? Like, is there something else that we need to really bear in mind, especially now, given the challenges that we're facing?
I think one of the more important things to be aware of now and to be holding space for now is that the level of uncertainty that we're all dealing with is at unprecedented levels. None of us have lived through a lifetime where we have so much uncertainty just staring us in the face every day. And that's going to affect us as parents, but it's also going to trickle down to our kids. You know, if they're in school and they're not in school now, that's a really weird thing for them. They don't know when school is going to be back. If they have been doing a homeschool version, they don't know how long they're going to be doing that. We hear that there may be a second wave in the fall, so we don't know what's going to happen then. So recognizing that with that level of uncertainty that we're all facing, it's like, on any given day, it can be the most stressful day of your entire life. And we chronically have so much stress that we're dealing with anyway. So now to have this whole new level heaped on, it means that a lot of us are having emotions come up that we wouldn't normally have access to, that would maybe normally stay kind of dormant inside us. And so that means that the parents need to be attending to themselves a bit more to make sure that they have emotional capacity to hold space for their kids. And we also need to be recognizing that our kids probably are having a lot more emotional stuff come up right now than they would otherwise. And it's not that they've just gone into a bad phase or become people that we don't like. It's that they're also dealing with unprecedented levels of uncertainty. So it's especially important for us right now to get really practiced at holding emotional space for ourselves and for our children.
Okay, absolutely. So I have some standard questions that we're going to ask everybody, that I'm going to ask you. And, certainly unprecedented times. Some would say that there's a global shift happening. There's like a total paradigm shift. And what is your hope for humanity and how we might evolve as a result of this pandemic?
I really, the hope I feel is like, well, the same thing that's our upset is also the same thing that's our blessing. Like, everything is so stripped down right now, just down to bare basics. Basically, the relationships with the people that you're in proximity with, locked in your house, you know, food, movement, it's just really basic. And that actually brings me a lot of hope because, as you can tell from this talk, the brightest actual future is dependent on that awareness of what's happening for you emotionally and how you can connect with another person around it. So with everything stripped down, and that part really gets highlighted, like what's happening in our relationships? How are we interacting with the people that we want to interact with? We can't do it just the regular old kind of slapdash way we've been doing it, rushing here and there and being so busy and like, well, relationships kind of happen amongst all this and all other stuff. It's kind of like the only thing we're doing. And so I really love that part because when we get really good at that, then solutions to all of our other problems become more possible. When we're in connection, when we have self-awareness of what brain state we're in and move through it and get into the executive, well, the executive brain is the one that would really just nail it on all of these problems that we have, you know, like climate change and class disparity and the design of how we want to run the country. Like, executive brain does that. So the more that we are aware of this connection piece and this emotional awareness piece, the more time we spend in that part of our brains collectively. So that's what I really like about this new era.
Mm-hmm. Nathan, how about you?
I think that if we can attend to it, I believe the current situation that we're all going through offers us an opportunity to really kind of dig into our emotional selves and to do some emotional healing that will help us become even more of who we really want to be. And I mean, digging into emotional healing that, again, we haven't had access to for most of our lives. It requires a situation like what we're going through now for that kind of material to be brought up. So we really have, I think of it as a real opportunity for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So opportunity to heal and really rise into our higher selves by doing this work, these practices. Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you. So what are we doing well already that you think makes you feel even more hopeful? What do you see?
To be honest, we had a little trouble with this question.
Okay. So we have a lot to do. Okay. Is there anything? and maybe that's the way it is, right? As you see it, it's falling. But, you know, I guess, you know, what I would just add that just us having this conversation, right? Because I'm a psychologist and there's been so much stigma around mental health. Like, it's those people over there. It's like, hello, like, we're all part of this. Mm-hmm. Can we just own that and really learn tools and practice?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, like, even though we weren't really able to say, as a whole, humankind is really doing so well in this area. We struggled with that. But many of us are actually taking this stuff really seriously, this part of, you know, mental health, emotional health, focusing on that for our kids. And in our work, what we found is that often we just work with one person from a family, right? One person from a partnership. Mm-hmm. And we help them to start rewiring their brain and how they respond to emotion. And then they go back out into the world, they go back into that family set or back into that marriage. And that marriage is different. That family set is different because they're showing up no longer from their survival brain and just getting more survival reaction. They're showing up, you know, from in their emotional brain or their executive brain, and that changes those relationships. So even though we weren't able to come up with like, yay, humankind, you're doing so well in this area, we do feel really enthused by the fact that some people are really focusing on this, and those pieces are out in the world affecting their systems that they're participating in.
Absolutely. So we need a critical mass of people to get there, where we want to go. So let me ask you, you shared so many great concrete tools that I think people are going to be able to start practicing already. But if there was one thing that you would like our viewers to action today that would make a significant difference for themselves and their families, what would that be?
We at the Center for Emotional Education, which we co-founded, we use the mnemonic device notice, name, touch. So for ourselves, you know, you get the reminder that it's time for emotional check-in. So you notice what's going on in here. And then you name two or three or four feelings, and then you add some touch. If you're just doing it for yourself, you can put your palm to your heart or to the nape of your neck. And those are connection points so that your system knows that you're being attended to in the emotion. And so it's safe to be with the emotion. And then if you're doing it with someone else, I was going to say there's the version where you can do this with your partner. So you get hugs for the touch part. So you would say, hey, can I do some emotional processing with you? I just want to name some feelings. And you get consent, hopefully. And then they say, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll hold you. And then while you're being held, you do the noticing and the naming of the feelings.
Nothing more than listing three feelings, naming them out loud. That's it.
And giving it a minute or so for the touch to have some effect. And then same with holding the space for our children. Hey, we want to do a little emotional check-in. I'll hug you while you name some feelings. And then give them an opportunity to say something about what they're feeling. With our kids and with others who, you know, like maybe our partner who hasn't heard this talk, they will probably tell the story of the feelings. And that's okay. You can support them in just telling some of the story that's up for them and then do a quick emotional translation. Where you're like, oh, so that sounds upsetting, or that sounds frustrating, or that, oh man, if it were me, I would feel so sad about that. How do you feel? Mm-hmm. So just trying to help them to dig in another layer after the story, just to name the literal feelings.
We see this as crucial because that emotional brain is the gatekeeper. When it feels safe, It's like, okay, you're good to go. You can do some executive processing. If it doesn't feel safe, survival brain sends you to survival brain. So just by doing these check-ins, nothing changes. You don't fix any of the problems. You don't say, okay, well, what do we do about that thing that's giving you those feelings? None of that. You just name them, notice them, name them, get some connection. And that's it. And that's enough for that emotional brain. Even though nothing has changed, it feels okay. It does not consider it an emergency situation. So this is actually how you change your moment. It's how you change your day. It's how you change your family. It's how you change the world. It all boils down to these 1 minute awareness check-ins of the emotional terrain.
Amazing. And I have to think that, again, like that is probably pretty preventative. Like we're just unpacking a little bit throughout the day so we're not full.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You're doing prevention chronically. Sounds mm-hmm. like a negative word, but routinely. Prevention routinely all day, every day. And then these acute moments of draining off emotion when they're upset. So there's these acute things and then there's the routine part.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Thank you so much for that. So Natalie and Nathan, I'm sure, you know, after today, with all the value given us and our viewers, there's going to be people who want to learn more. How do people get in touch with you and learn more about what you have going on?
Well, they can feel free to visit us at thecenterforemotionaleducation.com. That's our website. We have a number of courses available that they can find out more about there. We have coaching that we offer through there. We also even do training and certification for other coaches who want to use our modality of working with folks.
And actually, on our website, centerforemotionaleducation.com, we have a complimentary gift, which is a cheat sheet of the brain states. So you can put it on your fridge, and it can become part of just your family language. So it's just like your go-to, what are the signs of the brain state, and what do I do? What is it? What do I do? What is it? What do I do? You'd have just a real check-in spot. Yeah. So you don't have to memorize all of it. You just, you know, glance over and, oh, they're doing the thing. What do I do? Oh, this is what I do. We call it a cheat sheet. It's on the website.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Go get the cheat sheet printed out.
Yeah.
Paste it many places. This is so, so, so helpful. Thank you. Thank you so, so much. Again, Mindful World Parenting Summit. Check out Natalie and Nathan. Check out their website to learn more. Thank you so much, you two, for joining us today and doing your part in making this a more mindful world.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, real pleasure.